Welcome to the Be Rad Podcast, where we explore ways to pursue peak performance with passion throughout life without taking ourselves too seriously. I'm Brad Kearns, New York Times bestselling author, former number 3 world-ranked professional triathlete, and Guinness World Record Masters athlete. I connect with experts in diet, fitness, and personal growth, and deliver short breather shows where you get simple, actionable tips to improve your life right away. Let's explore beyond the hype, hacks, shortcuts, and sciencey talk to laugh, have fun, and appreciate the journey. It's time to be rad.
You can always come from a different direction and help people build up where they can start and then...
Hey, listeners, it's time for a rebroadcast of Dr. Tommy Wood's stuff. And he has some fantastic stuff. I can't speak highly enough about him and his sensible, common sense, easy to understand health information. Of course, he's a very accomplished physician, researcher, former head of the Ancestral Physicians Society. But he's walking his talk, is a very fit guy, healthy eating guy. And what I appreciate most about him is just bringing things into the area of sensibility and practicality. So it's a very easy to understand and follow show, but getting into good depth with science and the rationale for behaving, exercising, eating, sleeping, stress management, all the important things that we should do. Enjoy the rebroadcast. I want to discuss the incredible benefits of red light therapy and how you can get started with Mito Red Light. Mito, like mitochondria, red light makes the premier light therapy devices in the world and at incredibly affordable prices. I stand in front of my Mito Pro 1500 unit every morning, carefully exposing my eyeballs, other important balls, and my entire body to special wavelengths of red and near infrared light. When I tell people about my daily devotion to red light therapy, they typically ask, does this stuff really work? And the answer is yes, and there are thousands of studies supporting its effectiveness. Here's how. It's called photobiomodulation, where specific wavelengths of red and near-infrared light, red's visible, near-infrared is not visible, that's why it looks like only half of your panel's working, these wavelengths help mitochondria in cells throughout your body produce more energy and clear waste products more efficiently. Red light exposure helps mobilize nitric oxide trapped in the mitochondria and allows oxygen to return to the cell and increase ATP production. The benefits are proven again and again for skin health, muscle recovery, joint pain, and numerous inflammatory conditions. Red light therapy is also beneficial for circadian rhythm alignment because we generally get far too little direct sunlight and too much indoor blue light from screens and light bulbs at the wrong times. You don't hear much about this benefit of red light therapy, but when I turn on those lights, first thing in the morning, as soon as I wake up, I walk across the hall, I stand in front of the panels, and I feel instantly awake and energized. And believe me, there's a lot of days where Mr. Health Guy here wakes up feeling a little groggy and a little whiny, like I don't want to get up now and get into my morning exercise routine. But when I stand in front of the lights, in 1 minute, I swear I feel wide awake. I get all that grogginess out naturally. It's super powerful, super effective. Besides all the healing and the cellular benefits, I also love it for being a natural wake-up machine. You have to try red light therapy. I am certain that you will become a devoted user. And guess what? Mito Red Light offers a 60-day no-risk trial period and a special 5% discount for BRAD podcast listeners. Just visit Mito Red Light, M-I-T-O, redlight.com, and use the code BRAD on any of their products. Go for it today and get started on your red light journey.
Dr. Tommy Wood in the hood, up to no good. At the U-Dub with the bottle full of bub, we sit down for podcast number 3. Whoopee! Oh, what a pleasure it is to discuss all manner of healthy lifestyle, diet-related issues with the world's voice of reason. You gotta love this guy, Dr. Tommy Wood. He's up on all the science. He doesn't have an agenda. He's not touting or pitching a book or an angle or a product. In fact, he is so much so the voice of reason that he was the third party on this epic debate on the Minimalist podcast between carnivore advocate Dr. Paul Saladino, one of our great podcast guests here as well, and the plant-based kingdom dude, Rich Roll of the Rich Roll podcast. So that's right. Rich Roll and Saladino sat down to work things out, moderated by the Minimalist. But Tommy Wood was also on the stage with them, being the reasonable guy there, maybe the checkpoint guy to go through the science. I listened to the podcast. So it was pretty interesting. I would say that Saladino kicked ass. So go check that out on the very popular Minimalist podcast channel. On this conversation, and my freestyle rap was very much on target because we sat down at Tommy's office at the University of Washington Medical Center. So this show covers a great deal of ground. First of all, we talk about Tommy's experience on the Minimalist podcasts with the disparate opinions of carnivore and plant-based. And we get back to that a little bit. We get a little more deep into the carnivore scene and what Tommy's opinion is on that cool stuff. Then we discuss another occasion of disparate approaches, and that would be the fasting, time-restricted feeding strategy versus the benefits of eating good nutrition and getting adequate fuel for peak performance and recovery for fitness-minded enthusiasts. So I remind Tommy of his epic advice back in 2017 to eat as much good nutrition as possible to be as healthy as possible and athletic and recover. And I reminded him how I took that all the way into the Fatty Popcorn Boy saga. And you can listen to the show of that title to where I actualize Tommy's recommendation to eat as much good food as possible to the extent that you start adding excess body fat, which is a great sign that you're well-fed, well-nourished, and have gone a little bit over the edge there if you don't want to start packing on pounds the rest of your life. And I laughed at the time. It was such an obvious suggestion of how much calories should I eat compared to how many calories I burn, blah, blah, blah. And hey, if you start getting fat, then you know you're eating enough. And that's exactly what happened to me. So we review that a little bit, and then we get the fabulous number one best-selling book idea out of Tommy's mouth. Can you believe it? Here's the title: Eat Things That Look Like Food. How about that for simple dietary advice to take with you for the rest of your life? Another topic of interest we cover is testosterone and some of the confusion and misinterpretations of common blood tests. In particular, he talks about how getting your serum testosterone up and over 500 is a great goal, but at a certain point, more is not better, and you'll find out just why, and also how you might get confused by some of the readings if your sex hormone-binding globulin is high. And this is a very common occurrence for people that are eating in a low-carb pattern because they're insulin sensitive. It's going to be a wild ride. You're going to have fun. You're going to learn a lot. Love to have Dr. Tommy Wood back on the show. Let's get to it.
Dr. Tommy Wood here in his fabulous office overlooking beautiful green Pacific Northwest, University of Washington. Tell me about your recent career happenings here.
Yeah, there's been some interesting stuff going on. Last time I was on the show, probably more than 50% of my work was with Nourish Balance Thrive, which still exists and is still doing well. But for various reasons, I decided to focus more on academic research, which is what I do here. So I'm a research assistant professor in the Department of Pediatrics. I research neonatal brain injury. And at the same time, there's another entity that I'm working with, trying to develop a startup company to basically bring some of the things that we know about health and wellness and the things that we can do to support our own health and try and make that applicable to a much more general audience. We know that probably more than 80, maybe more than 90% of the Western population has the beginnings of a metabolic disease, and we know most of the ways that we can fix that, but it's trying to get that information and helping people support healthy behaviors is really difficult, but that's something that we're trying to do. So those are the things that I'm doing at the moment, but sort of my main job really for the time being is helping to run a lab here, looking at ways to treat babies with brain injury, but obviously still staying very well connected to all the health and wellness fields.
Well, this ambition to get this broad behavior change, it occurs to me, we were talking about this before we hit record, most people know pretty much what to do. They're just not doing it. So there's where our disconnect is. We have the knowledge floating out there. For the most part, I think there's some people that don't have the knowledge, or there's so much confusion and they're locked into a very strict diet that doesn't include animal foods and thinking that's the ultimate expression of health and their path to, you know, longevity. So there's a little bit of trouble there with the knowledge, but the general idea that we, you know, should go to sleep before, you know, hours of digital entertainment and not eat stuff that's coming in a wrapper that's an edible food-like substance. How do we get to the, how do we make that jump where people care about their health and take action?
Yeah, that's, you know, it's a serious problem. We know that these diseases, say, you know, Alzheimer's disease, they're calling it the disease that's going to bankrupt Medicare, Medicaid. And, you know, as, you know, people get sicker younger. And it's just untenable. But we also know that most of those things are due to the modern environment. But like you say, health is not, it's not, in general, it's not a knowledge deficit. And there's plenty of papers, you know, research that shows that, you know, giving somebody more information is not enough to change their behavior. So when a lot of people, you know, maybe people who listen to this show are people in sort of like really into health, you know, health optimizers. We're doing a whole load of expensive testing, genetics, nutrigenomics. Maybe they're doing stool testing, epigenetics. In reality, none of that is necessary for the average person to become dramatically healthier. You know, 80-90% of where their optimal is, and that's what most people need, right? So then it becomes about building healthy behaviors. How do you make it so that you have you know, an optimal sleep environment, or you're being exposed to sunlight during the day, or you're eating a nutrient dense healthy diet, or you're building social interaction, and those things. You know, there's plenty of, again, research out there in terms of how we foster behavior change. And we're hoping we can leverage some of those things to try and teach people to do that, because, you know, some people want to do these things for their own health. Maybe they're overweight, or, you know, they have high blood pressure, or they're worried about their risk of heart disease. And, you know, all of these things can be improved by putting some of these things in place. But we know it's difficult, A, because the evidence, in quotation marks, is confusing. So eliminating some of that is important. But then it's also, you know, how do you build these things into what most, you know, most people have a very hectic, stressful lifestyle. Like, how do you start to build some of these things in? So that's ultimately our goal.
Well, how do you? I mean, to me, it seems like it's a problem of instant gratification, decadence, luxury, consumerism versus, you know, we don't have like the rats in the lab where they get shocked if they eat a certain one of the foods and then they don't get shocked. It's like we don't have that instant electrical shock when we reach for something or stay up past our bedtime. So without that, we're kind of just indulgent every day or something.
Yeah. So there's a number of different ways to skin this cat. And I think what is being missed in general in this sphere, you know, a lot of people are starting to accept that behavior changes is the big problem, but, you know, they'll focus on one type of intervention, but different people respond to different things. So some people, like you say, some people respond to carrots, some people respond to the stick, some people need some kind of social support, others might need somebody who turns up right when they're vulnerable and says, hang on a second, you know, don't do that, do this instead. And that requires you to know the user, and also have the whole sort of available box of tricks that a health coach might use in real life, but, you know, hopefully automate some of that process so that you can figure this out yourself without having to spend money that a lot of people don't have to try and get some of this help.
So what about bashing over your head with a baseball bat like the screaming television celebrity trainer? That's not necessarily going to work for everybody. Is that what you're saying?
No, but some people are motivated by that. It reminds me of when I was living in central London and I was training for a triathlon, and I went to this spinning class. It was Wednesday nights. It was incredibly popular to book several weeks in advance. And there was this 6'5", very lithe, lean German guy who was the spinning instructor, and he turned all the lights off. and he'd play this incredibly intense techno music, and he'd wander around and just like scream in your ear, and people, they loved it. Like those people loved it, but like for a lot of people that is incredibly demotivating. So you just need to have, you need to have a, you know, a cheerleader style or something that really supports you in your successes, no matter how small, and then sort of helps you build on that, and again doesn't punish you or make you feel ashamed or whatever if you fall off the wagon, because everybody does that. It's a learning process.
Right. Maybe that's the first gateway, is to say, you know what, you're okay how you are, and figure out what works best for you. And if you're just into yoga and you don't like jogging down the block, then don't do it. I mean, you know, figure out there's some compromises and things here. But then, you know, on the next breath, when you get talking to an individual and they say, well, you know, I have a sweet tooth and I can't live without my bread. And so now you're like pushing that, you're lowering that bar down, and you do that seven more times with, I also like my Netflix in the evening. I need to unwind after my stressful day. And all of a sudden you're setting yourself up with, you know, not the highest potential.
Yeah. So then it becomes really important to build on small successes, but also focus where you can focus. So of all the things that I think are going to be important, they include sleep and circadian rhythm, diet, movement, social interaction, stress management, and then maybe environmental exposures. So almost everybody has one of those things that they could begin to work on. So, you know, maybe your biggest problem is the food that you're eating, but hang on a second, could we, you know, get you to go for a walk after you have a meal, right? That's, and then as soon as you start to see the benefits of that, feel the benefits of that, you have, you know, you're more motivated, or you feel you have more capacity to change other things that feel more difficult. So you can always come from a different direction and help people build up where they can start, and then you start to work on bigger things as and when, you know, they start to build some momentum.
So what have we learned from the extreme edge of the pursuit of optimal health, and it, you know, the massive testing that I was able to do through you guys and get all this information, and then also what the elite athletes are doing, the people that are pushing that absolute envelope of biohacking and all that? Have we had some incredibly valuable insights that are a must-do for everybody? Or should everybody get their blood tested at least once a year and then, you know, have a starting point like that? Or what can we do?
Yeah, so I think, you know, all of those things are important. If you're at, you know, the bleeding edge, either of performance,
the bleeding edge
of performance, or of health optimization, that data, that information, which you can then, and making sure that it's information you can then act upon, you know, can be incredibly valuable, and that's going to get you the last, you know, 5, 10, maybe 20%. But what I noticed, having spent a lot of time in that arena, is that most people do not need that, and at the moment, you know, and again, I'm talking about the average person who probably has pre-diabetes, right? Just teaching them how to, you know, eat better, or helping them build habits to eat better, sleep better, move a bit more. You know, none of that requires fancy testing. None of it is expensive. And it just requires support to make those habit changes. So you know, both are relevant. But when you're trying to think about applying this stuff to a more general population, you really see that the sort of the fancy testing that we've done, that I do believe you benefited from, is not something that everybody needs or wants or can afford, and therefore you have to make sure you're getting the most out of you know the really most impactful things, which are those you know, six variables that we talked about earlier.
Yeah, I think even referencing my time as an elite athlete, where I had to take advantage of every opportunity and treatment method and professional support, you know, being happy, being motivated, feeling like you're enjoying the journey was so much more important than any biofeedback or things like that, where if you weren't starting from that realm. And I'm thinking of this now because some of the questions that we absorb, you know, promoting the books, the Primal Movement, they're so precise and detailed and nuanced that it's like, you shouldn't even bother asking or answering these questions unless you take seven steps back and say, you know, are you being a jerk to your wife these days? Yeah. or whatever it is, are you connecting with your kids, or is this just an obsession to, like, you know, get out of other matters of life that deserve to be addressed, that are higher priority?
Yeah, and that is That's the real risk with the quantified self movement or the health optimization.
The quantified self movement.
Yeah, you know, that you you can get all this data, but a lot of the data isn't directly actionable, or people are not acting upon it. And at the same time, you are probably sacrificing a lot of those other things which are more foundational. And if you're doing all of those things right, then yes, this can give you the extra 5 to 10%. But if you're not, then you're not going to see any benefit anyway.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. I don't even pay for the blood test until I feel like I'm deserving of going and testing my blood, because I've been really eating well and working out well and things are going. I mean, or if I'm feeling like crap and I'm really trying hard and I'm trying to do the right thing and something feels off, sure, go get a test. But I think, wow, you know, the triathlete example of purchasing the expensive bike to save a pound of weight when you're, you know,
when you could lose 5 pounds by eating slightly better. Then,
right, yeah. Right. Okay, man, you got to set some things straight for me too.
All right.
Here we are.
Yeah.
This is now about a year and a half after your intervention with me, where I was deep into this keto thing, feeling great. Appetite was regulated, just like we say is so fantastic. And I'm fasting extended period every day. Everything's going fine. Doing these ambitious workouts and they're going okay. But then I'm, you know, noticing that I'm kind of a drag ass once in a while and I have crash and burn experiences, maybe 36, 48 hours after my sprint workout. And again, I'm over 50 years old trying to do this crazy stuff and break Guinness World Record. And so, you know, this mix and match of the stress factors of, let's say, a high intensity sprint workout for an older athlete and the fasting and the restriction of extreme restriction of carbohydrates from even my historical pattern of eating primally, was possibly making me a little sluggish. And you saw some of that on the results and you said, dude, go out there and eat more food, period. That was Tommy's parting words. And I experienced an immediate burst in energy, workout performance, and especially workout recovery. So I'm eating and eating and eating. I remember one of my passing comments or questions like, so how do you know that you've optimized your caloric intake or that you've gone on one end or the other? He goes, well, I guess if you started adding body fat, that would be an indicator that you're well fed. You're not in that depletion phase anymore. So then, yeah, a year and a half later, I stepped on the scale and I'm like, fatty popcorn boy, 172 pounds. Like, holy crap, is this thing right? I don't weigh myself maybe once a year for whatever reason, a physical or something. And I'm like, that's not right. But then I'm like, oh yeah, I guess it is, because I haven't really paid attention to this matter as a matter of priority in my life. But I had gained about 8 pounds of body fat over a period of time.
It was body fat. It was
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I even took a picture. I'll put it on Instagram someday to go, okay. And it wasn't, I'm still not in disaster zone. I'm still good metabolic profile, good athletic performance. But, you know, my insight was like, all right, so now I know what it's like going out onto the other edge of, you know, unregulated evening popcorn festivities where the family's around and I'm really good at making popcorn, drizzling the lemon flavored olive oil on top after a ton of butter and salt. And, you know, you start to get in the celebration mode, and then the celebration mode drifts into habit and routine. I'm kind of asking you a multi-phase question, because that's one of my concerns right there.
Yeah.
That I was very strict, very disciplined. I haven't eaten, nothing touched my lips that's been shit food for 10 years. I just don't care to go eat a ding dong. And I'm not going to, but popcorn's okay. And so is, you know, the gourmet handmade ice cream in Seattle, of course, is okay. And when I'm here, I'm hitting this stuff hard. But then as if I was to go buy ice cream and put it in my freezer throughout daily life after my wonderful vacation to Seattle, then these things start to ooze out of, you know, the intended maximum benefit. Yeah. So, you know, I guess my question, besides that the slippery slope, is one question. And the other one would be, where is that balance point between striving for caloric efficiency, getting by on the least amount of calories in order to have more time fasting, more better autophagy, longevity prospects with caloric minimization, versus maintaining my muscle mass, fitness, peak performance, because I want to live a long time as well?
Yeah.
Tommy takes a deep breath.
Man,
ready, everybody? This is why you paid for this podcast. Oh, it was free, but anyway.
Yeah, you get what you pay for. There's a lot there to unpack, and you're right. There is this slippery slope where you start to think, well, you know, I need more of this. Say, you know, I need to get more calories in. if you're somebody who has spent long periods of time fasting, carbohydrate restricting, one of the easiest ways to do that is to add back in carbohydrates, right? It makes maybe hunger increases slightly, caloric density increases, you can bring more of that in. There is a point at which you lose or you have a reduced ability to regulate calorie intake, and that's when the foods that you're eating have more than about 1.5 calories per gram. And once you get above that, once you're eating foods that are more calorically dense than that, then you know you run the risk of having to sort of enforce self-regulation, because otherwise the brain should be able to figure this stuff out, right? You overeat for a period of time, you get less hungry for a period of time after that. And of course, you can overcome that by saying, oh, I still need this, I still deserve this treat. But in general, if everything, you know, if you're under that, like, roughly 1.5 calorie per gram.
Of your body? Wait, 1.5 calories per gram of what?
Of the food that you're eating.
But doesn't everything have 4 calories, 4 calories, 9 calories per gram?
Yeah, only if if you imagine, yes, if you're eating dry pasta, that has 4 calories per gram. But once you cook it and there's now water in there, there's the water content and the fiber content that are going to make up that difference.
I see.
Right.
Okay.
So lettuce has almost no calories per gram, right? But if you dehydrated it, of course, you'll find some in there.
Dried fruit versus having
exactly, a
watermelon or whatever. Yeah.
And so that's the difference between basically refined and whole foods is essentially you end up crossing that threshold.
1.5.
1.5 is rough.
So it's difficult to ascertain.
Yeah, so you don't want to calculate that, but
right.
By the time you've got dry popped corn, which is already going to be closer to 4, and then you start adding olive oil on top, right? You're in that zone. Ice cream is certainly in that zone. So it's those kinds of foods that make it harder for your body to self-regulate. So if you feel like you're struggling to regulate, then making sure that all the foods that you eat are at or below that threshold, and that's like whole sweet potatoes are going to be much closer to popcorn, say. So that's a way to handle some of that. This balance of caloric efficiency versus, say, maximal performance, I do think that the idea of caloric restriction and caloric efficiency is slightly oversold. And I think we talked about that a little bit last time. And, you know, when you look at, say, caloric restriction, you know, it does work across, in terms of for longevity, it does work across multiple species, but it's not like a universal, it doesn't provide a universal benefit. So only like half of rodent studies see benefit in terms of caloric restriction. And a lot of it does also come down to food quality. And when you're looking at larger species, say monkeys, you know, the quality of the food that they're feeding these guys is so terrible to start with that if you feed them less of it, of course they're going to live longer. You know, it's like you feed them cheesecake and then you just feed them less cheesecake. And of course, the less cheesecake diet is going to be beneficial. But if you were letting these guys eat what they would find out in the wild, is there any benefit that caloric restriction is going to be? Is there any evidence that caloric restriction is going to be beneficial? And there isn't really any. And you have to remember that all these studies are done on animals who are so far removed from their natural environment in terms of the space they have to cover, in terms of how well they need their immune system to function. So there's some really nice papers that discuss the fact that, you know, calorically restricting an animal makes its immune system work less well. But when you're a lab rat, that doesn't matter because you have vets looking after you. You have all the, you know, you have all the pathogens removed from your environment. You know, all these things happen that mean that there's no downside to that. Whereas when you're a human in the wild being exposed to, you know, we talk about the non-vaccinated kids on Vashon Island, when you go over there, that's a potential risk. So there's, and then if you go beyond that, you can even look at the way that small animals die and what they die of and their mortality curves. And then for those where the metabolic rate per gram is about 7 times what it is for humans, they're much more likely to benefit from something like caloric restriction compared to a human. So overall, I don't really necessarily see that much of a benefit there. But what we do know is that obviously not overeating is going to be important, not gaining body fat. Once you're not doing that, restricting anymore, there's no evidence you're going to see additional benefit. But we do know that maintaining muscle mass and strength is incredibly important for longevity. So as long as you're, you know, you reach the point where you start to gain weight, and then you hold back, and you make sure your body weight's stable, and you're still able to perform well and maintain your muscle mass. Like that's absolutely the golden spot. Like restricting or pushing any further than that because you think that you'll get more autophagy or more longevity out of it, there's not really any evidence to support that. And I'd worry then that you start to lose muscle mass and lose strength, and that's to me, that's more important for your long-term health.
Or I would say lose that intangible of recovery rate.
Yeah.
You know, my change in muscle mass, change in body composition is probably inconsequential relating to my life expectancy. But, I didn't like it. I preferred to. I dropped the 8 pounds really quick. Thank you, Tommy, from just cutting out the popcorn, sprinting. And because I was... able to perform so well the previous year and a half, I could put more sprint workouts in.
Yeah,
because my body was really, trained at a higher level because I was getting on enough food. And then I guess I could drop in an aside. Like I think the cold exposure when I jumped in the chest freezer for a few minutes every morning.
Yeah,
I feel like that might have kickstarted some fat burning. And I also feel like there's a counter to that, which is increased appetite. So what I did was like I'd go in the cold plunge every morning, and then I'd make a rule that I wouldn't eat any calories until noon. So it was maybe 4 hours where I would at times experience like an intense burst of hunger sometime after that cold plunge, and it would last 15 or 20 minutes. I think that was ghrelin, peaking in my stomach and making noise. And if I just rode it out, I felt like I was in this, enhanced fat burning state to get this pack off my body. For it took 3 months, and I'm back to I dropped about 8 pounds. I think it was all fat, and it feels good, like psychologically, to feel like, hey, I'm back in an athletic realm here. But definitely want to optimize that going forward. But it sounds like we have two different bags here, where if you're carrying excess body fat or proclaim that you're carrying excess body fat, you have sort of different set of decision-making parameters than someone who's at an optimal body weight and just wants to be healthy, enjoy life, have some ice cream instead of pass, that kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. I think you're for the cold exposure, I think you're absolutely right. When your body temperature drops, your core body temperature drops, that is generally hunger promoting, and it's one of the reasons why swimming tends to be less good. If you look at the studies, it's less good for promoting fat loss, is because your core temperature drops from being exposed to the water, and then you are hungrier relative to the amount of exercise that you've done compared to, say, if you burn the same number of calories going for a jog or something like that. So that core temperature can definitely be a tricky thing. So it sounds like you got a nice workaround there.
Yeah, the swimmers burn a ton of calories, and because their body temperature isn't hot, their appetite is ravenous. Whereas if you do something that heats yourself up, you're going to have a curbing of an appetite effect for a while anyway, right? Yeah. Okay, so if you're struggling to reduce excess body fat, then I'm reminding your great insight from the last show to communicate this carefully, is first you get metabolically healthy. And then you try for this caloric restriction, reduction of carbohydrates generally. Mm-hmm. Can you tee that up again?
So we talked about last time how the drive to store body fat can be protective in a number of ways, but at some point it backfires, and that's where you end up with more systemic insulin resistance. But up until that point, your body fat is your buffer. It's keeping you metabolically healthy, up to an extent. But in order for your body to be happy to lose weight, it helps to be healthier. And so you need to at some point figure out some of the drivers of that body weight gain. And yes, of course, at some point you are probably in a caloric excess, but was that driven just by the fact that you're eating too much, or was it driven by your poor sleep or by your stress or by, say, your environmental exposures? There's some people who think that if you're exposed to, say, a lot of plasticizers or maybe some heavy metals, other things that might be in your drinking water and your food, the best place to sequester that is in your body fat. And when people fast, fully fast, and like just water fast, you see a dramatic increase of these toxins in the blood because they're being released from the body fat.
So you feel like crap.
So, yeah, so you can feel like, you know,
while you're losing weight.
While you're losing weight. And so it actually, very dramatic weight loss may actually be quite bad for you. And that's one of the reasons why, is because you end up releasing all this crap that was stored in your body fat, but you're not supporting the pathways that, that help you get rid of it. So trying to, you know, do some detective work in terms of what really are the core issues for you that may have helped drive the weight gain that you have. And then reversing those first is probably going to allow you for much more sustained long-term fat loss.
And how big are you on the environmental aspects? Because some of this stuff's freaking me out, where people are talking about the EMFs and, you know, it's destroying your humanity and the plastics. So you got to just not touch anything that has plastic with it. And then I was talking to my cousin, Dr. Steven, from the Los Alamos National Laboratory. He's a rocket scientist, so he has shirts that say, yes, I really am a rocket scientist, uh-huh. and all manner of, you know, working that thread. But he said, these are the emission is so minimal that he gave me permission to use my Apple earbuds.
Yeah.
And, you know, every time I put them on, I feel guilty. Like, am I frying my brain right now? And I feel like there might not be a definitive answer yet because they're so new. So that's even more scary.
Yeah.
But then if a rocket scientist says, don't worry about it, times 100 with your whatever, your laptop and the wireless signal when you log in at the apartment complex and there's 27 other wireless people, so you're like, shit, that can't be good that all this stuff is touching my brain right now.
Yeah. And I think you're right that we don't really know what most... what most physicists, engineers talk about is whether there's a thermal effect from the EMFs or, you know, the radiation they're being exposed to. And that certainly is not the case with most Bluetooth and Wi-Fi and things like that. However, there is a huge amount of evidence to suggest that these things do have a biological effect. And, you know, you can think about that either from like a cellular perspective, the effects they might have on different mineral channels, electrolyte channels in the body, to the effects that, you know, the interacting effects between the electromagnetic fields that your cells produce in your mitochondria. And we know that electromagnetic fields interact. That's why when you put like a magnet on your old cathode ray tube TV when you were younger or something like that, you see like the whole image warps. We know that these fields interact. So I think there's both evidence and like mechanism to support a biological effect. The problem is that we have no idea the magnitude of it, right? Is it that these things cause 0.1% of all the issues that we're seeing in terms of metabolic health, or is it, you know, something truly meaningful? I just don't know yet. I know that they have an effect, but it could be so tiny compared to everything else, but it might not be. So there are, you know, people are worried enough that in countries in Europe, so Sweden, I think, has banned all Wi-Fi in schools, and a lot of countries are going in similar ways. We know that having your cell phone in your pocket as a man decreases your sperm count, which then to me tells me it's probably going to decrease testosterone levels as well. So, you know, high level exposure, you know, all day, every day, I'm sure is having an effect. But, you know, does that mean that you should be worrying about it whilst not improving how you eat and how you sleep and all, how you move? Probably not. I would still start there. But, you know, it's probably not negligible.
So there's validated that cell phone in your pocket lowers sperm count and testosterone?
Yeah, not testosterone. It hasn't been looked at, but there are enough studies. And I think that's what actually, you know, compared to like brain cancer from cell phones, all that stuff, I think the one area which is less disputed is that cell phone in the pocket and sperm quality certainly decreased.
Where do we put it then? Give it to your girlfriend.
No. So I have it in my... So if you're somebody who does have... And again, this is something that you can look at. So if you do have low testosterone or you have fertility issues, this is something that I take into account. If you don't, and like testosterone's good, you know, feeling good, libido's good, you don't have any fertility issues, again, don't worry about it. Different people are going to be susceptible in different ways. But for me personally, it's probably the thing that's going to be the closest to my body. So when I'm moving around, say I went to pick you up from downstairs, my phone's in my pocket. As soon as I sit down, the phone comes out. That's just like control it as much as you're able to easily control it. And then, you know, I'd stop worrying about it after that.
same with drinking out of plastic. If yeah. you're thirsty and you're out on the road, you yeah. get a plastic bottle and down it, but you know, don't refill them seven times at home
yeah.
with the permeable. Right.
And when you and when you're at home, so when I'm at home, I filter all my water. I have a reverse osmosis filter. So that means that maybe 80, 90% of my water is filtered. The other 10%, you know, if I'm really thirsty, I'm not going to worry about it. If it has a bit, you know, that's fine.
Therefore, you're sleeping better, not worrying about these things.
Yeah.
And raising your overall score.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm very much in favor of the approach of control the things that you're able to control or willing to control. And if
oh excuse us
if you're not allowed
we have an out there
if, yeah. but I mean if
I need my bread Tommy I need my if, my sugar fix
if you're not willing to control it then maybe you don't care enough and that's fine and maybe you have other priorities again that's fine like nobody's judging you if you want to eat a load of bread that's not I don't mind that's fine but you can make that decision for yourself but control the things that you're able to or willing to control and then beyond that like don't worry about like literally worrying about it is just going to make it worse so.
Well, on that note, I feel like, you know, I'm looking for sources of motivation and trying to study that in myself and other people, you know, and this fear of pain and suffering and demise 20 years from now or 25 or 10, if we're idiots and don't do anything about it. I want to find a little bit of fear to light me up so I can continue to do these workouts that maybe I don't feel like doing right now, or maybe I'd have, more unregulated caloric intake if I didn't have some notion that I want to have a long, healthy life.
Yeah.
And I feel like that might be a connection that's missing for people too. It's like you're lighting up these cigarettes or assorted drugs and pharmaceuticals that seem to be prevalent in the norm in today's society, and they're predictably going to lead to pain and suffering.
So are you trying to ask about ways to get people to... to focus on the long term rather than the short term.
Or saying like, hey, everything in moderation. You can yeah. say that 17 times a day and rationalize every single thing that you do to the extent that now you're sitting here with blood markers that are borderline or whatever. And you know, where do you get that where people can, as collective society, say, hey, we're the smartest, most affluent society in the history of humanity, and also the fattest and least healthy in many ways. Or, you know, here in the U.S. with the medical advancements, we're 37th in life expectancy. We're behind
even
Costa
that
Rica.
High. I thought we were lower than that.
We're behind Costa Rica, who also kicked our butt in soccer. I mean, it's like...
hey, so I'll maybe you don't know this story, but I was in Costa Rica in January. Yeah. I was bitten by a snake.
He got snake bit, bitten, literally.
Bitten by a poisonous viper. I spent 11 days in a hospital bed in Costa Rica. And Costa Rican healthcare system is great. It gives you just what you need. It's socialized healthcare. You know, everybody gets the treatment that they need. And there's a lot to be said for that. It's not fancy. There's no bells and whistles. You know, of course, if you wanted something super technology advanced, you probably have to come to the US. But for the most benefit for the most people, it really, you know, gets the job done. And they have better life expectancy than people in the US who have, you know, arguably much better technology and spend a lot more on healthcare.
So you got out of there in one piece, but it was an ordeal, man.
Yeah, yeah, it was. got bitten by this snake. And
what were you doing?
It's literally nothing particularly exciting. I was walking along a road. There's a stream that crosses the road, and this snake. It was at dusk, and we had been warned by the guy who I was walking with. So the guy who runs the retreat center, my friend Dr. Ben House, which is awesome. If anybody wants to go and like lift weights in the jungle, you know, I definitely recommend you go to the Flow Retreat Center.
I like that name.
Incredible. Yeah.
Lift Weights in the Jungle Retreat Center.
Yeah.
What's it called? Flow Retreat Center?
Flow Retreat
Center. That's a good name too.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so, yeah, I'd been there for a few days with the guys from NBT, and I'd actually had a lot of work to do. So I'd spent most of my time just in the retreat center, and he was like, hey, let's go for a walk. And we went out and got bitten by this snake, and then we got him and I agreed. We were like, we don't know what kind of snake it is, but you know, we'd much rather be the silly gringos who get worried about it and go to the ER and they're like, oh, you're fine, and send us away, rather than it being like a bad snake and then you find out about it later. So we got in the car, and you're sort of driving down this mountain road to get down to the road, and He's sort of communicating with his site manager, who's a local, who then went back and found the snake and then found out it was a bad snake, it was a fer de lance. And they're like, I can feel the like truck picking up speed as like Ben tries to like get me to the ER faster. But actually, when I got there, they were particularly worried. I hadn't gotten a big dose of venom. They check by the amount that the site bleeds, because they inject an anticoagulant. So if it bleeds a lot, they know it's bad. It wasn't bleeding very much. And then they took some blood tests as well that look at your blood coagulation, because the real risk early on is that you have a hemorrhage, say, into your brain and die because your blood isn't clotting. So I was fine from that standpoint. But what actually happened to me was that I got a really bad infection. So I needed multiple different types of antibiotics to get on top of my infection. So I had an abscess inside my leg that they had to like cut open and drain. And I had like a big red swollen leg, basically all the way up my right leg. And it took, so I had almost 11 days of antibiotics in the end, before they got on top of that. So that was the main problem. But like I said, I was really happy they had expertise and they knew what they were doing. And the hospital was clean, if not, you know, super modern, but yeah, I was very happy with how it all went. I was very lucky.
You got released, you were able to go home.
Yeah.
And then did you have more recovery time after?
Yeah, so it took probably 3 to 4 weeks for the wound to heal. So on like maybe two days before I left, the main doctor sort of basically just sliced open my leg with a scalpel, and they just like squeezed all this pus out of it. And then you can't like sew that back up, so it leaves an open wound, and then you just have to like change the dressing. So my wife was changing my dressings twice a day, and it got looked at by some of the first day I got back, I got looked back by some of the surgeons here in Seattle. They were super happy with it, so actually they just let us look after the wound by ourselves. And then after that, it was just a case of slowly building it. So I had to spend a lot of time on my leg elevated, so slowly like walking again, and then, you know, moving around a bit more, and then, you know, over like a couple of months starting to like lift stuff in the gym again, and just sort of build all that strength back up. I lost 20 pounds, so I had to gain
speaking
all that
of
weight back.
Losing and gaining weight,
yeah,
so that would be like 18 pounds of muscle or
yeah it was pretty much probably close. It was probably, you know, perfectly in proportion with my body composition. So, something like that. And it took a while to build that back up, but that was all right. I did the unregulated eating for 2 or 3 weeks, and most of it came back pretty quickly.
And what was it like getting back into the gym, or starting from? Did you have an extreme attrition in your baseline fitness standard?
No, it was okay actually. Even though I haven't gone as heavy as maybe I was lifting this time last year, you know, I know that I'm pretty close. So I'd obviously, because of the leg, I went in and did upper body stuff to begin with, and I maybe do like 3 chin-ups and 5 dips and I'd be done, and then I'd like go and sit down. But like, you know, you just sort of slowly build it up. But actually once my leg was fully healed, the 80% that I'd lost came back pretty quickly.
I want to tell you about wildhealth.com. They're an online provider of comprehensive precision medicine and health consultation services. They offer DNA analysis, custom lab panels, extensive medical intake form with family history and lifestyle preferences, and regular online visits with a board-certified precision medicine physician and a health coach whom you can message anytime through their convenient app. Wild Health evaluates your data to determine what you need for nutrition, exercise, sleep, and supplements, and you can experiment, consult, and retest to get everything dialed in. You'll get a cutting-edge epigenetic test of DNA methylation to calculate your all-important biological age and have fun lowering your age over time instead of following the mainstream path to accelerated aging. It's time to strive for awesome instead of just normal. Did you realize that only 6.8% of Americans are deemed metabolically healthy and only 2% are declared optimal? That's disgraceful, but you can turn things around quickly. Please visit wildhealth.com and you will see that this is the absolute gold standard of personalized medicine, and it's available to you right now. Telemedicine available anywhere in the USA. Wild Health is generously extending BRAD podcast listeners 20% off the cost of membership. Just visit wildhealth.com/Brad or use the code BRAD20 at checkout to get 20% off and start taking control of your health today at wildhealth.com/Brad.
We went down into Costa Rica because we were talking about life expectancy in the US.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, going back to that, in reality, everybody is an adult. They can and should do whatever it is that they want to do. Obviously, giving people the tools for those who do want to try and change things, improve their long term, health and lifespan, is important. But you're right that the big problem becomes instant gratification versus long term benefit, and most things. So like, the people who are super interested in longevity, who may be taking various supplements, maybe they're taking rapamycin, metformin, any of those things, how are they going to know whether it worked or not, right? What's the feedback loop? You have no idea. And are they even going to take it now they've started taking it? Are they going to take it every day for the rest of their lives?
Yeah.
Because what happens is people will take a supplement or a drug, particularly if they're doing it for a health benefit rather than to treat a disease. After like a month or 6 months, they'll get bored. They'll stop taking it. And that's incredible. Everybody has a drawer full of supplements they don't take anymore, right? You're going to take this thing because it was going to make you healthier. It's going to make you live longer. You don't take it anymore. And so that's the big problem, I think, in sort of the longevity and wellness space, as people call it at the moment, is that most of those things do not become something that you're going to do long term. It's a shiny new thing that you try for a while. You never know if it actually gave you any benefit. So trying to build in some feedback loops. So that's something that we've tried to do with the blood chemistry calculator, and other people are doing, can you look at your blood tests and they assess how old your blood looks. You can do the same thing with methylation, epigenetics, maybe with telomeres. I'm not a big telomere fan, but possibly.
Oh, you're not a big fan, you said?
No. Largely because the if you're measuring telomeres in your blood, which is usually what we're doing, you're measuring telomeres in white blood cells, which are the cells in your blood that have DNA for you to measure the telomeres of. But different white blood cells, just at baseline, have different telomere lengths. So depending on the proportion and number of different white blood cells that you have, and those have a circadian rhythm, those are affected by a whole host of other things. So your telomeres may get shorter or longer, and actually, that's just because there were a different population of cells that you measured the second time you measured it. So it's just far too variable, and not that accurate for my liking. Maybe that will improve in the future. I'm sure it will.
But right now, the people are touting this. You can go Google the word telomeres, and it says these are the caps on the end of your cells. And the longer they are, the longer you're going to live, and the shorter they are, that means you've been partying like a rock star, and you're going to have. And so, yeah, to me, it doesn't seem like anything's that black and white.
No.
And
in reality, so say that your telomeres are shorter than expected. How do you know what to do about that? The things that you need to do about that are all the things that we've already talked about. So you need to do that anyway if you're not doing it. You didn't need a $300 test to tell you that. So that's the big problem with a lot of these tests is that, and now so there's some epigenetics testing, methylation testing. There's something called the glycan age, where you basically look at the glycosylation. So HbA1c is a glycated hemoglobin. It's the sugar moieties are attached to your hemoglobin. That's measured. But you can do that for all kinds of proteins, and you can do that in a blood test. It sort of gives you this wide score in terms of how much your proteins are coated with these glycation products. But the thing is that it doesn't tell you anything about what you should do about it. And in reality, if you are doing these things to try and improve your long-term health, you probably already know what it is that you are deficient in. Like we talked about, it's not a knowledge deficit. You know what you need to do. So having these tests doesn't necessarily help you because it gives you no indication of what you should do. So in general, just change the things that you know you need to change.
The HbA1c is the amount of glucose that's been circulating around. More is worse, and a higher score is seen as worse. So wouldn't it be cut carbs if your HbA1c is over 6 or whatever the danger is?
Yeah, so for HbA1c, that's a good example. There are some confounders of that. So the HbA1c within an individual person, tracking your HbA1c over time is definitely beneficial. Using your HbA1c to compare yourself to other people doesn't work very well because each person for a different average glucose level will have different amounts of HbA1c. So it's not very, it doesn't allow you to compare to others, but you can track yours over time.
Oh, right. Your cells might live or die in a different lifespan. And so you'll have a higher number.
Yeah.
Could you cross-reference it to a healthy glucose level and say, maybe I'm not so concerned as I might be otherwise?
So when people report an HbA1c on a lab test, often it will tell you what your predicted average blood glucose level is, but in general it's just wrong. It's not true. Like
besides that, it's nice to see on your lab report.
Because
besides being wrong,
there's like a
very handy, it has a nice beautiful graphic presentation.
So like if it says that your average blood glucose is say 100 milligrams per deciliter, in reality it's probably anywhere between 80 and 120. And that's a big difference. That's the difference between like super healthy and diabetic. So it's just so variable from person to person. One way that you might adjust for some of that is looking at the number of reticulocytes you have in your blood. Those are new blood cells. And if those are very low, then that means that your red blood cells are probably living a really long time. And if they're living a long time, then they have longer to get glycated. So then you have an artificially higher HbA1c. So that's kind of if you're worried. And again, I mean, I know that you wanted to maybe talk some more about carnivore and keto and some of those things. And in that population, it certainly seems that their HbA1c is quite high. So or it can go up over time. So if you're worried about that, something like looking at your reticulocyte count will let you know whether if you have really long-lived red blood cells, then that's going to artificially elevate it. And you just have to remember that what you're comparing yourself to is a sick population. Like we talked about, more than 80% of people in the US have at least one of the markers of metabolic syndrome, or you know, markers on the way to metabolic syndrome. So that means that more than 80% of people already have metabolic disease, and that's who you're comparing yourself to. So it's really difficult to say, you know, the range on the lab test is what that is, or that the lab gives you is the one that you want to aim for, because the population you're comparing yourself to is already so sick.
So speaking of that, if I'm interested in preserving a healthy testosterone level by decade, am I looking at these ranges of sorry ass wussy boys because that's the norm? And so do I want to be in the 90th percentile if I have high ambitions? And same with numerous other things on the blood report.
Yeah, so it definitely depends from test to test. So for testosterone in particular, yes, testosterone has average testosterone has decreased over the last few decades, and that could be for multiple reasons: food quality, movement, maybe like
plastics,
maybe EMFs. So for testosterone, it's important to remember that like enough is important, but more isn't necessarily better. So I generally say that, so say somebody in their 40s to 50s or older, as long as you're over 500, you're probably in good shape. But the normal range will go down to usually down to 250, but that's definitely too low. So somebody 20s to 30s, maybe you want to be 600-700, and then, you know, you can naturally expect that to come down 100 points over the next like 2 or 3 decades, and that's fine. So, but usually above 500,
It's not fine if I want to throw down on 30-year-olds, though, is it?
It probably doesn't make that much difference. So enough is important, but more isn't better unless you're at a point where you're taking exogenous testosterone as a performance enhancing drug. And then yes, you will get to a point where more is better, but there'll be a payoff in terms of say cardiovascular disease. shutting down your prefrontal cortex, so you're no longer good at decision making.
Really?
All those kinds of things.
That's a side effect of androgenic use?
Yeah, so testosterone generally, if you're interested in it, you should read Behave by Robert Sapolsky. But one of the things that he talks about is how testosterone essentially modulates the function of the prefrontal cortex, which is there to help you make smart decisions, essentially. And so it doesn't like having high testosterone doesn't make you make stupid decisions, but it makes you more likely to do the things that you are likely to do anyway. So if you're somebody who's normally very impulsive or normally has a tendency towards aggression, testosterone will make that can make that worse.
So you were talking serum levels when you said 500 to 250 is low. Yeah. Is free testosterone more important, I hear, sometimes?
Or? Yeah. So
I love the size. But
not to me. I think in general, total testosterone is enough. And things get really tricky because you do have, a free androgen index calculated, free testosterone calculated. That's based on things like your SHBG, your sex hormone binding globulin. But in general, in the people that I've worked with, SHBG is at the top end or above the normal range. And so then that, you know, may start to proportionally lower your free testosterone. But these are people who are performing well, feel good, great libido. And again, you know, the best way to decrease you. So a lot of people think about trying to decrease their SHBG because they want their free testosterone to be higher. And you can do things like if you're zinc deficient, taking some zinc will help. Boron will help. If you're deficient in certain minerals, then that can certainly help. But beyond a certain point, the best way to lower your SHBG is to become obese and insulin resistant.
Oh,
right. And so if you look at SHBG versus insulin sensitivity, it's a straight line. So the more insulin sensitive you are, the higher your SHBG. So I find people end up worrying about that a lot more than they need to. I
think right.
Total testosterone tells you more than enough.
And you go check your low insulin level against high SHBG.
Yeah.
I was alarmed, and you and Chris helped talk me down there, and it was just pretty simple.
Yeah.
So we're again so far out of the normal realm that you have to kind of get a little more deeper than just going to the blood test and looking at which one's green and which one's red.
You can't do that. And there's, you know, when you're then, this translates over to things like, you know, advanced testing for cardiovascular disease risk. And the normal ranges or the risk ranges are based on this same population of people, the majority of whom are on their way towards metabolic disease. So do these things still count in somebody who's active, metabolically healthy, sleeps well, eats well, moves, you know, frequently, and we just don't know. And so, we're trying to apply some of these things to a population of people that until essentially very recently, you know, didn't really exist. It just makes it really hard to figure that stuff out.
They didn't exist.
Yeah.
They were just Martians came down and stopped eating processed carbs for the first time in 9,000 years.
You know, in the modern environment, you know, people who are trying to create a more ancestral environment within, you know, the modern constraints, it's a fairly new thing, you know, but at the same time, we've had a dramatic increase in the amount of data that is available for people that we can compare ourselves to that can help assess our risk. But the majority of that data is collected in sick people.
That's right. They're the most voluntary. Yeah, sure, take my blood again today. I can't do anything about it. I'm chained to a hospital bed. Okay, I'm going to have to call this the Dr. Tommy Setting Us Straight show.
Uh-huh.
Because you're just keeping us focused. That's what I love about you, man. We're just getting some of this stuff locked down. And then one of the big items on my list I'm going to hit you with is this carnivore thing.
Yeah.
And I like to quote the classic movie Spinal Tap when the rock star David St. Hubbins said, I believe virtually everything I read, and that makes me a more selective human. And I'm kind of that guy myself, where I'm trying to remain open-minded and get away from dogmatic, fixed, narrow beliefs that I'm so rigid that I'm unwilling to to listen to an alternative point of view. So I listened to Dr. Paul Saladino go on about the carnivore diet several months ago, and you know it stuck in my head because you know the way he conveyed his argument was very measured and sensible, and looking at the other side and saying, well, you know, the counter argument to this is blank, blank, and the science shows this. And so it was really, it's a nice presentation. It's a nice concept. But it also feels like here's the next extreme dietary binge where people are going to jump on the bandwagon like they've done with keto and completely bastardized it and misappropriated the concept of nutritional ketosis as it was intended when Mark Sisson and I wrote the book, and the other keto experts are going in saying this is the benefits of it for your brain and your seizure protection, and now it's like bring a stick of butter to you with for lunch so you can get enough fat.
Yeah.
So let's talk about a little bit of this carnivore premise, particularly the idea that we don't need plants and they might actually be bad, especially for certain people that are highly sensitive.
Yeah, so that's those aren't the same thing, right? The do we need plants versus are they bad for us? And I think that's a big crux of what we still don't know about carnivore. And you know, Paul is a good friend of mine. We've hung out a lot. I really like him. He's, you know, compared to some people in the carnivore movement, he's very measured. He's very
nose to tail
intelligent. Yeah, he actually, you know, thinks about nutrient quality, nutrient density, you know, how we're getting all the things that we might need, and that is going to be probably a nose to tail approach. I completely agree with him. And it can be absolutely magical, you know. But you know, Paul, a number of Georgia Ead, the guys who run, it used to be called Paleo Medicina, is based in Hungary, where they use what they call Paleolithic ketogenic diet. Is basically a high fat carnivore type diet for multiple different pathologies, autoimmune disease, some cancers. These guys are saying,
"Oh yeah, that's where Dr. Kate said if she gets diagnosed with cancer tomorrow, she's headed to Hungary.
To get
crazy treatment."
But I mean, it's not really that crazy. The interesting thing is that they basically talk about, or they show stepwise improvements in people who, like, first they went paleo or they went keto, but they didn't really see benefits until basically they were eating a diet that was 10% protein and the rest animal fat, and that's it.
Is this cancer patients or what?
Cancer patients, oh, and mercy. Then some severe autoimmune disease.
Where would you go if you got diagnosed with cancer tomorrow? Besides UW, maybe you'd be okay.
Well, I mean,
what would you do?
I would. That's a good question. It would probably depend on the type of cancer. I would probably think about a diet like that. Again, depending on the cancer, there are some cancers where being ketosis doesn't seem to give any benefit, may be detrimental. So it would depend. But then again, also depending on the cancer, I would also consider chemotherapy, depending on, but probably spend a long time reading papers to make that decision. So yeah, it depends. That's my favorite answer. But these guys are seeing great benefit in a wide range of diseases. And there's a number of potential reasons for that. It could be that, yes, for some people, fiber really is irritating to the gut for a number of potential reasons. Could be due to the microbiota or, you know, other ways that their immune system has changed because of their environmental exposures. And therefore, they just can't tolerate these things anymore. But the issue that I see is the question of whether this is optimal for everybody, and we don't really have any evidence to support that. So recently Paul, myself, and Rich Roll were on the Minimalist podcast. It opens with a carnivore, a vegan, and an omnivore walk into a podcast. That was essentially and it was actually really good. It was talking about minimalist diets, you know, how can we try these different things to try and optimize our health. And when you think about somebody like Rich Roll, who is, you know, staunchly advocates a whole foods plant-based diet, just like Paul advocates a whole foods animal-based diet, these guys are, you know, in themselves and in others, are seeing great benefit. Like, why would you even begin to argue with that? Like, what, you know, if somebody is trying something and it works and they feel better and their health improves, I don't see any point in really arguing over like what is a human intended to eat. And sort of beyond that, what I really wonder is that, what does it tell you about us as a species when we are starting to become incredibly sensitive to foods that we know our ancestors ate? We know our ancestors ate plants, right? Even if it wasn't in times of abundance, maybe they were purely carnivore, but at times in between, they were definitely eating plants and they were surviving well enough to reproduce to go out and hunt, to go out and forage. Like, it was definitely not holding them back. But now we're at a point where you have some people who advocate carnivore or keto, and they're like, as soon as I have any carbohydrates, as soon as I have any fiber, my health falls apart. And at the same time, you have people like Ray Cronise, who's a big plant-based guy. He says, as soon as I have salmon more than once a week, my blood sugar starts to go up. What does it tell you about this person that their blood sugar starts to increase when they have salmon more than once a week? That just doesn't make any sense. It tells me that there are other things that have not been fixed, or there are other issues still going on. And if you think about a lot of people who are, you know, well known in the carnivore space, they're overweight software engineers who spend all their time inside sat down, right? And then, yes, maybe to get your blood sugar under control, you have to really restrict your carbohydrates. But if you started to think about sleeping well, stress management, movement, you know, adding back some muscle mass, maybe socializing with people in real life, you know, maybe some of that stuff doesn't matter anymore. So I think the reason why these restrictive diets become almost necessary for some people is because we've built an environment that basically completely removes our ability to adapt or use different things from the diet. You know, we're completely unable to tolerate, you know, new, novel, different things, and we just have to restrict more and more and more. I think that tells us more about the fact that we are no longer resilient as a species than it tells us about that we should be eating that everybody should be eating a certain way. Does that make sense?
Oh, sure. I mean, it reminds me of the asthma and allergy statistics, where the only child that lives in an urban environment has much higher incidence than a kid on the farm, a kid who has a pet, a kid who's the second or third child, because the parents start to get tired of antibacterial wiping up everything. And it makes perfect sense that the more exposure you have, the more you toughen up.
Yeah. Right. And I think first of all, we don't have those exposures that do make us tough, do make us resilient. And we've also, you know, there are all these things that we need to be healthy, you know, in our environment that we no longer have, such as, you know, like light and dark at the right time of day, or, you know, frequent movement, or, you know, nutrient dense foods, you know, all those things we've talked about. We've engineered them out of the environment. And then you get to a point where, yeah, maybe you do need to be super restrictive in one area just to try and regain some health. But I don't think that tells you anything about the fact that, like, carnivore is the way that everybody should be eating.
Oh, I feel that's a way to reconcile this confusion. When you're sitting there with a super healthy vegan, like my friend Rip Esselstyn, we go back decades racing on the professional triathlon circuit days in the old days. And, you know, he's extremely healthy, prominent promoter of the plant-based lifestyle, the Engine 2 diet, and the great work his father's done at the Cleveland Clinic reversing heart disease with plant-based diet. But you're talking about departing from the nasty standard American diet and then drawing a circle on a page and pointing an arrow out in any direction. This could be carnivore, this could be vegan, and you're both going to have tremendous improvement because you stop going to nasty Ben and Jerry's ice cream with industrial seed oils and processed sugar in there.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and a lot of the proponents of these more, and I don't want to call them extreme diets because I don't really feel like, for the person eating them, they're that extreme. So that's kind of a
specialized diet.
They don't feel they're restrictive either. So none of those adjectives are particularly fair. But they often get there by being really sick to begin with, right? And you have this person who was already sick because of all these other factors, and then they found something that helped them control it. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the diet itself was the issue.
Right. And they're so fervent because they believe deeply in their heart that they're going to change the world, because they were on their deathbed and then they stopped eating meat and they had an awakening. But yeah, we got to be careful with dispensing our, your personal experience and projecting that onto others.
Yeah, absolutely. But the thing is, I'm a huge supporter of both Rich and Paul. You know, these guys are really helping people reclaim their health. I see value in both. I don't think that they're necessarily mutually exclusive. You just need to kind of, to me, it's just a trying to put it into a bigger picture where it all still makes sense, despite the fact that people are eating completely diametrically opposed diets, yet still seeing great benefit.
So yeah, it's what they're not eating.
Yeah.
The best benefit of the carnivore diet, let's make the top 10, mm-hmm. the best one is no shit food.
Yeah.
Let's make the top 10 of the vegan diet. The best one, number one is, well, I guess vegans are still maybe eating their Starburst. So we'll say the plant-based.
Yeah, whole
right?
food. That's why.
Whole food plant-based.
That's why sensible vegans say don't call it a vegan diet. Call it a whole food plant-based diet because that tells you what's in it. I'd certainly agree with that.
There we go. Yeah. So let's say we're starting point. You and I are not suffering with huge autoimmune or inflammatory conditions. We just want to optimize and so forth. So let's say we have the freedom to go look for what foods are going to promote health more than anything else. And putting aside the enjoyment factor, and I have to have my broccoli, otherwise I don't feel like the day is complete. Let's just say I'm a robot and I'm going for the record. I want to live to 123.
Yeah.
What kind of foods should I necessarily go looking for?
So I think that you probably have an incredibly wide range, and that's what makes it so confusing. So and when you're talking about
hold on, I got to tee off our audio engineer Luke, because that was the quote of the
that's a poll quote.
We have a wide range, and that's what makes it so confusing.
Yeah, and it would be so much easier if
are
it
you
was...
putting ice cream in there from Seattle if it's handmade.
Yes, you went to Salt and Straw, didn't you? My wife would have told you should have gone to Molly Moon's, but maybe you can
start. Oh, shoot. Yeah. You know where we've been? Frankie and Joe's,
yeah.
Salt and Straw, and Central District. I've hit three homemade ice cream.
But you haven't been to Molly Moon's.
We got to go to Molly Moon's.
Got to go to Molly Moon's.
Okay. The quadruple.
Yeah. And yes, that could certainly be a part of it. So, but, you know, maybe you focus on, you just focus on food that looks like actual food. And it sounds like really trite, but that's essentially where you start. And so it looks like food that came from the thing that was in the ground or was the animal that was before it. And if you do that for most people, that's and you're going to be at the point where there's nutrients that, you know, it's nutrient dense, it's not calorie dense. And so all of those things you need in terms of regulating appetite, in terms of getting all the nutrients you need, all of those things exist. And yes, from there, you can certainly move one way more than the other. And, you know, maybe you want to base that on how you feel. Maybe you want to base it on some blood tests in terms of some of the nutrients that you might need more of. But when there was this point that I wanted to make about the carnivore diet specifically. And again, this is the difference between do we need plants versus are plants bad for us? And do we need plants? No, probably we don't. And when you look at, say, there are some randomized controlled trials where they add meat into the diet, and actually there are no detriments seen. There's only benefits seen. Interestingly, overeating meat doesn't seem to cause weight gain in the same way as overeating other, you know, more refined carbohydrate based foods, which is just interesting. Again, it has not a huge number of studies, but some studies that suggest that do exist. And then there are also studies that where they add plants to the diet, like vegetables, that not much really happens. Like, is it good? Is it bad? Doesn't really make any difference.
That kind of takes a shot at the plant-based movement here.
Yeah. So again, so there are absolutely
that's brutal, man.
You
just punch the plant base in the stomach. Doesn't really matter. And they're saying that is the essence of healthy living. So.
Yeah. So when you just add plants to the diet, there are randomized control trials that have done that, and they're just like pretty much equivocal.
And whatever.
But
would you like some broccoli with your meal? Whatever. I don't know.
And there's one interesting trial where they basically had people eat the same thing, but in one of them, they basically removed the plant based antioxidants, and in those people, their like endogenous antioxidant state improved more than those with the plant based antioxidants. So actually, and that's interesting, isn't it? That suggests that if you're giving plant based extracts that have antioxidant properties, you know, that maybe they're not necessarily that beneficial, because you know your body can and should make its own. But so if you just add plants to the diet, doesn't seem to make much difference. But there are plenty of studies using a whole foods plant-based diet where you do see benefit. But again, where's that benefit coming from? It's from the foods you're not eating all of a sudden, rather than the foods that you are eating. You have to admit the single most successful long-term weight loss trial, the broad study, whole foods plant-based diet, they ate it for 6 months, they lost a huge amount of weight, and they kept it off for another 6 months after the trial finished. That's almost unheard of in any dietary trial. So again, they taught people how to cook, they base the food on real whole food, and these people lost a huge amount of weight and they kept it off. So the plant-based community, you know, if I was a plant-based guy, I would literally put that study upfront, you know, more than anything, it's like it's the best study that's been done on a plant-based diet. And I don't hear about it that much, but it's incredibly successful. But I think, you know, most of the success comes from more people aren't eating and teaching them to eat whole real foods, and they taught them how to cook. And once you have those skills, then I think, you know, whether more or less plants or more or less meat, you know, is probably, you know, secondary.
Wow. Dr. Kate Shanahan says the same thing, and she's working with private employees now as her main career outing, and wants to teach them how to cook as her highest ambition, and, yeah, and believes that she can make the most impact just teaching them how to enjoy and make good meals. And so possibly in that trial, if it was a carnivore trial, someday someone's going to tout the 6-month carnivore trial, and they taught them how to cook all this cool organ meats that they never knew how to cook before, you're going to have fantastic success and keep the weight off.
Absolutely. I absolutely expect exactly the same thing.
So it's that behavior change aspect rather than this splitting hairs, yeah, and championing one agent over the other. But I think that thing you briefly mentioned about the plants not necessarily or having a potential negative antioxidant benefit. It seems like Dr. Saladino is championing that really strongly, that if you get rid of this stuff, you do better with internal antioxidant production. You'll replace the purported benefits of your acai bowl and your Jamba Juice fresh squeeze. Is that the idea here?
Yeah. So the idea is that most plant-based antioxidants, as you'd call them, are pro-oxidant, but what they do is they actually use up your endogenous antioxidants, but they stimulate your body to make more. So that's the way that they work.
That's tripping me out, man, because I mean, let's slow that down, because people need to understand this. When you eat that blueberry, broccoli, kale, the antioxidant powerhouse superfood, as the poster says, these are actually have pro-antioxidant properties.
So they have pro-oxidant properties. They cause oxidative stress. But what that does is it causes the cell to respond and produce more antioxidants. So it's a hormetic effect.
So it's a complete misnomer,
yeah,
to say that eat your kale salad, it's high in antioxidants. But what you really mean is it's going to trigger a high antioxidant cellular response in the body because it's a pro-oxidant.
Yeah, it's going to stress your cells to increase their antioxidant production.
Would that be like a cigarette? And a kale salad? Can we?
Yeah.
Brad Kearns is jumping into the science realm. You mofos better watch out there, because he just said cigarette versus kale salad, both pro-oxidants.
Yeah, so I don't think that cigarettes have ever been shown to have that kind of benefit. So this is where things get super interesting. In that one trial where they did show that, it was in no way connected to any health outcomes, right? So you don't know if you just change that in a short period of time, is that a good thing or a bad thing? You know, we don't know. There's also plenty of studies where if you take something like sulforaphane that extracted from cruciferous vegetables, broccoli, cabbage, broccoli seeds, you can give that in very high doses to rats. You can give it in high doses to humans, and it doesn't seem to have a negative effect. Whereas, you know, somebody who is very anti-plant would say, oh, you know, it's toxic, it's a goitrogen, it's going to affect thyroid function. And it doesn't seem to. So
why is someone saying that? Are they citing a different study? Or
no,
how do we?
It's a theoretical. So we know that some of those things in cruciferous vegetables have the potential to interact with thyroid function, their goitrogens. But when you give those isolated, so sulforaphane directly activates NRF2. That's the pathway that gets activated by oxidative stress. So that's what's being activated by a lot of plant-based antioxidants. There are actually pro-oxidants.
So brutal.
So it's kind of the way I think of it. So it's all the way I think of it is that, you know, essentially what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, right? So exercise. If I measured your blood test straight after you did a heavy sprint workout, I'd think, Brad, that was a super bad idea. Like, you look like you're in really bad shape, but your body adapts, it becomes stronger. The same thing happens with a lot of these plant-based antioxidants. Now, some people would say, yes, but there's no downside to exercise, but there is a potential downside to these. Like, they might be goitrogens, they might affect your thyroid function in high doses. But that doesn't seem to be the case, and we don't really have a way to resolve this. At the moment, it's all still theory. My question is, if you look at all the studies, and we know nutritional epidemiology is useless. We know that the blue zones who tend to mainly eat plants, although they do eat meat, but they, you know, the majority of their calories come from plants. You know, they live a long time. It's probably because they move and they meditate and they socialize and, you know, they eat whole, like, locally grown food. It's maybe less what they're eating and all that other stuff, right? But even in all of those studies, all of them suggest that, you know, plants have potential benefits, right? There's no signal that any population that eats more plants is sicker, right? So when somebody's saying, you know, in general, plants are toxic to humans, we should be carnivores, there is no, like, I want to see one study that suggests that on a large scale, and I can't find any. So yes, carnivore can be incredibly beneficial to some people for a variety of reasons, but that's not, you know, and there's evidence to suggest that adding more plants to the diet doesn't really do anything and may make maybe worse for some people because of fiber or some other stuff. But that doesn't mean that in general plants are bad or that nobody should eat plants, right? There's you just need to make sure you separate out which bits of evidence support what you're trying to do.
Yeah, it reminds me of my philosophy one class in college, critical thinking, where you have the, you know, if the street is wet, every time it rains, the street is wet. If the street is wet, does that mean it's raining? And you say, not necessarily. It's so simple. But then when you go down to, you know, week 7, when I started to struggle and had to get a private tutor, this stuff, what you're just explaining is mind-blowing, because if we apply what you just said, push rewind, people, we'll wait for a little, and listen to the stream again. If we apply that model to everything we're exposed to in everyday life, when my mom sends me a text and says, look at this, it says red meat shortens lifespan. Headline story. I think it was this week, blasting the news everywhere. Then you got to take a deep breath and slow down and go, okay, they're counting, you know, nasty ass bacon, sausage, fast food hamburgers as red meat. And then, you know, again, think critically and extract all these things. And then we're pretty much left with the Tommy Wood epitaph, I don't know, maybe, which, you know, Dom D'Agostino, when I interviewed him about keto for an hour, he said, I don't know, so many times, I finally started laughing. I'm like, dude, that seems to be your favorite answer. And he said, watch out for any scientist that doesn't say that a lot. He goes, because then these are the guys that get on TV and spout conventional, you know, they shape modern culture more than the real, you know, the fine scientists that are open-minded and don't want to make conclusive things, but we're instead pulling and looking for these black and white, shorten your telomeres, lengthen your telomeres, don't eat plants, you're good to go, don't eat meat, you're good to go, and then we're left with a mess rather than continually open-minded. But that one thing that that makes some sense to me, I want to clarify or ask if this clarification is accurate, where Dr. Saladino says, yeah, there are hormetic stressors, right? Hormetic stressor means a brief positive natural stressor. If you haven't heard that word, right, it has a net positive benefit. But so is sprinting. So is me jumping in the cold tub. So is me going in the sauna, etc. So do I need another hormetic stressor with the broccoli and kale salad? Or might I just sprint, go in the cold tub, go in the sauna, and fast rather than have the broccoli kale salad and get all these wonderful benefits that were undisputed?
Yeah, and the answer is I don't know, right? And so and this is the thing. And what's so what I think we can say based on the evidence that we have is that you don't need that, right? You may well benefit from it. You may feel good doing it, and that's great. And then please do it. Does that mean it's essential for everybody to do? No, it doesn't. And that's, I think, where we are. That's where we are currently. So if you know what's important for anybody to do if they're trying to decipher some of this stuff is track how you feel. Maybe track some basic blood tests. There's a number of things you can do to look at, you know, your metabolic health, maybe your nutrient status, and then change something, and then again continue to track all of those things. So some people will start, you know, will feel much better when they add a huge salad into their diet every day for a variety of reasons. Some people will feel worse
because of that. Or add more calories, for example.
Yeah, or add more calories, or, you know, add a steak, you know, and right. I've worked with people who, you know, previously on some kind of a carnivore diet, and they added back some plant-based foods with some carbohydrates, and, you know, they felt better. Other people, strict carnivore, feel great all the time. Some people feel great, you know, work with some particularly, you know, some well-known athletes who do really well on a vegan diet. Others did terribly and they started to add back plant, you know, animal foods, and they felt good. Like, that's just the way it is. You have to be able to do some, you know, are any of these things 100% necessary? No. So then it becomes a part of your, you know, just a part of, figuring out your own puzzle.
You think diet is oversold in general amongst the, you know, listeners to the show, not oversold to the public in general. They best be paying more attention to it. Yeah. But in the realm of people who are deep into this, you think it's the effects are oversold?
I think that once you are eating something that looks like a primal type diet, that's it. Right. That's the vast majority that's required for most people.
You named your best-selling book during the show. Did you realize that? Looks Like Food by Dr. Tommy Wood.
Just eat food that looks like food. That's legit. I recently joined Instagram, and I haven't done a lot yet, but I posted a thing of me with the plant, with the vegetables that I'm growing. Me and my wife are growing in my garden, and like I said, there are many ways to approach diet, but the most important thing is just to eat food that looks like food. And most people, if that's what they do, then beyond that, you probably don't need to worry about it anymore. There's probably other things that are much more important in terms of your sleep or your exercise, or, you know, worrying less about your food so you can go and spend time with friends. You know, some of that becomes much more important.
And people, who's saying this, but a very high profile leading researcher in this world, and he's telling you don't worry about it so much. So don't worry about it so much. Hopefully we'll minimize the email inbox of hair splitting nutritional questions and relax a little bit. Yeah. and get that bump in healthy living. Dr. Tommy Wood, how do we find you on Instagram?
So I'm at Dr. Tommy Wood on Instagram.
No one had that.
Nobody
You're
had that.
You're a latecomer to the game.
Yeah, no, I was really happy.
Incredible, because I have some dude named Brad Kearns who's apparently an accomplished snowboarder, and he's got Brad Kearns Sick Air on YouTube. When people are looking for health advice, they got to go watch some guy flying off a snowboard jump. But at Dr. Tommy Wood at Instagram.
Yeah, that's who find me. I'm at Dr. Ragnar, Ragnar on Twitter. So at Dr. Ragnar was taken. I tried to have on Instagram too, so I had some
What is Ragnar?
Ragnar is my middle name.
Oh, I thought it was the famous bike ride or...
Oh, yeah. So, well, there's
Ragbri.
Well, there's also the Ragnar Relay.
Okay.
Ragnarok is the final battle for Valhalla in Norse mythology. It's also Ragnar's also my granddad's name. So...
Lovely.
Yeah. But so at Dr. Ragnar on Twitter, although I haven't spent much time on Twitter recently, at Dr. Tommy Wood on Instagram.
Thank you for setting us straight, as always.
Well, thanks for coming to visit me. Thanks for schlepping to my office. You deserve some ice cream this afternoon.
Absolutely.
I want to tell you about wildhealth.com. They're an online provider of comprehensive precision medicine and health consultation services. They offer DNA analysis, custom lab panels, extensive medical intake form with family history and lifestyle preferences, and regular online visits with a board-certified precision medicine physician and a health coach whom you can message anytime through their convenient app. Wild Health evaluates your data to determine what you need for nutrition, exercise, sleep, and supplements, and you can experiment, consult, and retest to get everything dialed in. You'll get a cutting-edge epigenetic test of DNA methylation to calculate your all-important biological age and have fun lowering your age over time instead of following the mainstream path to accelerated aging. It's time to strive for awesome instead of just normal. Did you realize that only 6.8% of Americans are deemed metabolically healthy and only 2% are declared optimal? That's disgraceful, but you can turn things around quickly. Please visit wildhealth.com and you will see that this is the absolute gold standard of personalized medicine, and it's available to you right now. Telemedicine available anywhere in the USA. Wild Health is generously extending BRAD podcast listeners 20% off the cost of membership. Just visit wildhealth.com/Brad or use the code BRAD20 at checkout to get 20% off and start taking control of your health today at wildhealth.com/Brad. Thank you so much for listening to the BRAD podcast. We appreciate all feedback and suggestions. Email podcast@bradventures.com and visit bradkearns.com to download 5 free ebooks and learn some great long cuts to a longer life, how to optimize testosterone naturally, become a dark chocolate connoisseur, and transition to a barefoot and minimalist shoe lifestyle.